obedience is not tolerated.
Alright, hey everybody out there, welcome to another episode of, it's coming titled Terror Hawks. I'm RP Wilson, and here I have with us, always, is our man Lucius Luminix. So we're going to knock out a couple things today. We're going to work on some Fantastic Four, you know, excitement. That's coming up soon. We're gonna work on some. We're gonna try to hit some Ant-Man stuff also. Potentially post Convergence and Secret Wars speculations, and then we're gonna dive into some major topics that include what is a pilgrimage, you know, within the comic universe. We're gonna hit up some Spider-Verse stuff, Sandman, and you know, we'll probably finish off with a few things at the end. So. I'm going to throw it over to Lou. Lou, what's up, man?
Yeah, so I'm actually really excited about this Fantastic Four stuff. I know you were saying this is like the first time you've been excited for Fantastic Four anything. I'm kind of excited that the franchise might find a better niche as a sci-fi franchise as opposed to being contained in a comic universe, because I think the only thing that's really kept the Fantastic Four relevant after, you know, them being Marvel's first team super family is that they've made Reed smart enough to have him around when you do stuff like the Illuminati and whatnot. And
yeah, for sure. For sure. I've never been interested in anything Fantastic Four. Even on my inception on my introduction with comic books. And, you know, just my general affinity to Marvel versus DC. And I remember I asked the comic book guy that kind of got me started, like, so the Fantastic Four, I know they're like Marvel's first comic book. And, you know, like, what? Like, why are they still a big deal? And he was like, it's really just a family story and how. And he sold it to me really well. And I was like, oh, that's pretty dope. But even after him selling it to me really well and being, and I'm all excited that. The story that he told me was awesome. I was still like, it's just still the Fantastic Four. So the way he broke it down for me was, it's a family-centered story with Reed Richards being the main protagonist, and you have to look at it as Reed battling his arrogance, and how his arrogance led his family and his family and his closest friends to this. You know, less than superb outcome. You know, they're all radically changed. His best friend, who's a pilot, and told him, "Hey, this isn't a smart move." You know, but Reed with his hubris, saying, "No, we're still gonna do it." His best friend turns into this just grisly, unsightly looking type of thing, and you know, a lot of it is like, at least on the inception. What my comic book sensei, as Stone and I call him, was telling us was, it's kind of like a part of it is him, Reed, trying to figure out a way to redeem that, you know, I guess that mistrust or whatever, trying to find a way to cure Ben Grimm, you know, of this physical affliction. And I was like, oh, that's really dope. And then, you know, they start, and it's like, yeah, they're not really superheroes. They're just like a super family. And I'm like, oh, that is awesome. But I'm still not excited about the Fantastic Four.
Because they're in the world of superheroes, and they're just some super family. And I think that sci-fi angle is really cool, because it's like, you put it in the realm that's their story. Like, it's a science mishap that they're really trying to fix. You don't have to group them in with the larger MCU, which kind of makes them seem insignificant. And the full embracing of this sci-fi story has seemed to have some really cool stuff come out of it, like Reed's powers actually being spatial distortion.
Yeah, man, that's sick. And I'm thinking, that's why I'm super excited, because I'm thinking, hey, I love sci-fi stuff. I love comic books. This seems like a very good marriage right now. And what's not to like? They're definitely pulling a lot of stuff from Interstellar also, where it's like the pseudoscience makes sense.
Yeah, and since the comic book has been canceled, you know, they can walk out the other side of this and say, no, this is the Fantastic Four now. This is the pocket we want to keep them in if all goes right.
Right, and that's another super exciting thing, because I think one of the things, just through some individual projects that I've been doing, you know, listening to the other podcast and reading about how the how a lot of artists and writers, mostly writers, I'd say, they're trying to, well, I won't say a lot of writers, but select writers, they try to create this dynamic storytelling where you kind of evolve a character out of a, you know, out of, say, out of the stasis, like just out of this stable equilibrium that they're usually in, where it's like, all right, these are the things that will always be, say, Batman, or these are the things that will always be Spider-Man. And some writers nowadays are like, we're trying to evolve past that, where it's like, okay, so cool, let's take the Fantastic Four and just kind of move them and keep them maturing. And the best analogy for me is, in the real world, there will be a generation of kids who won't even know that Otto Octavius was a bad guy. That's kind of like what I look at it now, where it's kind of like the Fantastic Four can kind of do the same thing, where it's like, in the real world, there'll probably be a lot of kids in the future who won't realize until told later on that Johnny Storm wasn't black, because they're like, Johnny's been black since 2014. I don't know what you're talking about, Uncle Lou. No, but actually, Johnny was a white guy, and he actually was around since 1963. They're like, what? And then you pull up a Wikipedia, you know, entry, and it's like, wow, he was really actually a white guy.
Yeah, I think Marvel's fully great at embracing that and not turning back. You know, yeah. DC sort of has taken the alternate route in like the past 5 to 7 years and was like, psych, where we don't like that Batman wasn't Bruce Wayne anymore, we're going back. Marvel's really good at sticking to this. And especially since Johnny Storm being black wasn't a staple to his character.
Yeah.
You know, the staple was that he was Sue's sister, and, you know, in the year 2015, he can be black, Sue can be white, and they can still be brother and sister.
Right, yeah, and that's super cool. I think that's the other thing that I'm really excited about. It's just sort of the Fantastic Four truly evolving. And I'm like, hey, this is really dope. It's one of the few, you know, movie cinematic properties that Marvel, that's like somewhat linked to Marvel, or, you know, whatever, we'll look at it, because whoever owns what, that's just a can of worms of its own. But it's one of those things that's like, wow, you know, it's a really cool Marvel property that's actually evolving, not on paper, but like in front of your eyes. Like, hey, this is a thing you can look at and say, oh crap, that's just awesome.
That's very so, true, because everything else will probably evolve behind it, because in the comics right now, Marvel is evolving left and right. You know, they're going to walk out of Secret Wars and be something completely different. And
right,
this is a sample of the type of stuff that Marvel has been doing.
Yeah. And I know a quick thing before we... And the Ant-Man thing also is actually really kind of interesting, too. But before we jump on that, the Marvel evolution and how they push... how they've been doing this for a while, it struck me while I was listening to this other podcast that I frequent a lot with Carol Danvers, and how she actually, in a sense, evolved in her own way, where, you know, she initially was Miss Marvel, And then she took that helm as Captain Marvel, which, you know, which she kind of took up after Mar-Vell, the Kree scientist, died or left or whatever you want to say. He was no longer on Earth. She just took that helm and how she's evolved. And she's always been a very progressive character in her own sense. And it's like just learning about her evolution and sort of the way Chris Claremont, he was writing X-Men back in the 70s and 80s, how he just kind of pushed the edge of progressiveness, especially with women characters. I was like, yo, this is actually pretty dope. It's like, wow.
Hey, short, simple, related statement. Check your boy, Sam Wilson, a.k.a. Captain America.
Exactly. That's, yeah. And I'm pretty sure there's probably going to be, you know, no turning back on that part either. Like, I can't really just see them saying after Secret Wars, you know, after Secret Wars is over, you know, we're actually going to go back to Steve. Nah, that's really not going to happen. I'm quite sure that Sam is going to be Captain America for a while. Like, I can thoroughly imagine Steve Rogers being Captain America only within the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and then that's probably only until, say, the Infinity Gauntlet is over. The Infinity Wars is over, and then it's like, yeah, Sam is going to actually take that, and then we'll have, say, Sam Wilson within the comics being Captain America for 10, 15, 20 years. Like, who knows? That's the other thing where another way we can potentially have a generation of kids growing up simply reading, you know, the Avengers and only seeing Captain America as a black guy. And they're like, and then, you know, us as older people being like, hey, so did you know that Captain America used to be this guy named Steve Rogers and he was white? And then they're like, what? Shut up. Stop telling stories. And they were like, no, look at this. Look at the Avengers back in 2010. This is Captain America. So yeah, that's really fun. I think that's one of those, that's a really fun thing right there.
Yeah, so Ant-Man.
Oh yeah, so Ant-Man. I'm actually excited about Ant-Man too. I'll say I'm a little more excited for Fantastic Four than Ant-Man, but I'm excited for Ant-Man simply on the fact that the things that they've been showing us seems really cool. And it seems like just the creative, and I mean a lot of creative staff, they're always saying that they're super involved and they're in love with the project that they're doing. Because, you know, you gotta toe the company line. Whatever project you're working on, you're going to be super, super excited and in love with it. But these guys genuinely seem excited about Ant-Man. And I know before Paul Rudd and Peyton Reed and, you know, and Adam McKay, I believe, for those three guys were like on it writing and directing, it was supposed to be, it was a totally different, writer who was doing the screenplay prior to that, and you know, and he fell off of it. Yeah, I actually can't remember his name right now.
Edgar Wright, because Joss Whedon was like
Edgar Wright,
because yeah. Joss Whedon was like, that was the best script Marvel ever had, and they threw it out the window.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of people were really upset about that, because, you know, they were saying Edgar Wright did such a great job with that. What is it? Shaun of the Dead, right?
Yeah.
And all those other just offbeat comedic pieces of cult fiction kind of movies. And it's like, yeah, like Edgar Wright would be the man for the job, you know? And
yeah.
And I mean, you know, things fell apart. Things didn't fall in line. It's a relationship at times. Ant-Man was talked about and rumored for, I believe, close to a decade or maybe even over a decade. They were talking about Ant-Man. I think Kevin Feige, he even said that, I think when they went to San Diego Comic-Con in 2006 or 2005 or whatever, one of the, kind of like when they were about to introduce Iron Man, like Ant-Man was the thing that they were talking about, and you know, it was always talked about, and then it just didn't really work out, you know. But Paul Rudd, I like Paul Rudd. I like him as a leading guy. I like him in a supporting role also. I really like him as a leading man. He's really funny. He's charming in the movies that I've seen him in. He's always very charming. And he's not really a funny guy. Like, he isn't a sitcom type of person, or I'll say a stand-up. He isn't a stand-up kind of guy, stand-up comedy kind of guy. He's just gotten kind of, I guess you'll say, looped into it because of Anchorman and Anchorman 2 and all that stuff.
Right.
Where it's like, oh yeah, Paul Rudd, he's the ha-ha funny guy. But he's actually just an all-around versatile actor. And initially I had reservations on Ant-Man because it wasn't Hank Pym as Ant-Man. You know, it was Scott Lang, and it's kind of a heist story, basically, where, you know, Scott's being recruited by Hank to steal something most likely related to the Pym particles, and, you know, Scott's got a kid, he's got his little girl and all that stuff, and he's trying to be a good role model to her. And I was like, oh, well, they're kind of just kind of forgetting everything about Hank Pym and what he's done and the contribution that he has. But just through reading a couple reports, Peyton Reed actually said that he'd be really, really interested in doing either a sequel or a prequel that covers Hank Pym's history as Ant-Man.
Yeah, I just read that also. And
yeah.
And I like the whole thief thing, because it's still edgy. Because my thing on Hank Pym was, it's like, ah. But even though I haven't really read him in Marvel, like, stuff I hear, it's like, Hank Pym's a really interesting character, because in his secret life, he is not the best man at all.
Right. Yeah, exactly. He's not a great guy, really, you know. And, you know, just to kind of throw it, like, in his private life, like, him and Jan, like, they come to blows many times, and, you know, in a sense, there is domestic violence. Like, that's a thing that you can't avoid. Like, Hank Pym does beat up Janet, which is his wife. Like, he beats up the Wasp, you know, when they're out of their superhero stuff. So, like, and he does all these great things, but he's not a great person. So, I kind of understand Marvel, well, Disney, really, because Disney's still a family-friendly type of company. That's the image that they want to portray. Can definitely get them wanting to move away from that, and that's I think that's one of the things that a lot of people said they attributed to why they wanted to not use Hank Pym, because, you know, people will say, hey, well, Hank Pym is a wife beater. So, you know, if we're gonna call a spade, so they're like, hey, let's not do that, because we're still family friendly, or we try to make it seem that we're family friendly. So let's do Scott Lang. Yeah, he's a thief, but, you know, people steal, but he's like an honest thief, or, you know, he's a thief with a conscience, because a lot of the crimes that he committed was to acquire capital to help his sick daughter. So they're like, oh, okay, oh, you know, that makes sense. It's a ignoble act, but it's a noble cause, or whatever. So yeah, but it's still edgy with the thief thing. It's still edgy with the heist plot point. Because, I mean, who doesn't like a good heist story? Ocean's 11 comes to mind. That was pretty good.
Yeah, I actually like a bunch of heist movies. Reservoir Dogs comes to mind.
Reservoir Dogs, awesome. Yeah, Reservoir Dogs, The Inside Man.
Yeah, The Inside Man.
That was
Man.
Pretty dope. That was really dope. So, yeah.
So, yeah.
A lot of great heist movies.
And I think it just adds that much more depth to the MCU. You know, we've got Daredevil over on TV. Unconventional street-level hero. We've got demigods and super techies. And now we've got a thief.
Right. And, you know, the other thing is, and I'm not sure how they're gonna weave him into, say, Marvel Captain America Civil War, because they're definitely there. In the article that I read, you know, Ant-Man article, they were saying that he's gonna have an appearance in Civil War. But I like that he's not super powered. So here's another guy who's going to be interacting with the Avengers in some way, shape, or form, who isn't super powered. And, you know, so Hawkeye essentially won't feel alone. Even though Cap isn't super powered, but Cap is a super soldier, it's sort of like, you know, Ant-Man, Scott Lang's whole thing is he has a suit that shrinks him. So other than that, you know, he's just a regular guy. And, you know, like Hawkeye said, you know, I'm on a flying island with a bow and arrow. So, yeah, it's one of those things. I'd like to see how they're going to be interacting, you know what I mean, being the two non-superpowered people at the moment.
Yeah. Ant-Man. What's the drop date on Ant-Man?
Drop date on Ant-Man is July 7th. It's July 17th, I should say. So it's 2 weeks from now. Yeah, exactly 2 weeks from now, since July 3rd. So I'll definitely be watching that on premiere date. I also feel as though it may not come... So the other thing about Ant-Man before we potentially move on to Secret Wars, actually we might just jump to...
Yeah, I think we'll just jump to the major topics.
Major topics. The other thing on Ant-Man before we do jump to the major topics is that it's generating a little more buzz than Guardians of the Galaxy. So if/when it does do well, it won't come as a surprise as Guardians of the Galaxy. But I also do believe that it won't be as successful as Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, that's not me saying that it won't be successful at all. It's just me saying that Guardians of the Galaxy is just kind of really one of those super duper sleeper hits, like nobody expected it to just do that.
Guardians of the Galaxy, I don't even know why they keep trying to get that comic to work.
Yeah.
And I remember their initial attempt at a Black Panther movie was scrapped for Guardians of the Galaxy, and I was just heated at the movie because of that. Like, I was watching in the Comic-Con news and they were like, no Black Panther, Guardians of the Galaxy instead. I was like, why the heck would you take away T'Challa for a comic that gets canceled after like 12 issues all the time?
All the time.
And then it was a really good movie.
Right. So it's like, yo, you know. So anybody who's going to see Ant-Man, you know, definitely go in there with optimism, because it's going to be a fun movie. It's going to be really, really enjoyable. But try not to throw the comparison with the Guardians of the Galaxy and Ant-Man. Because, I mean, I think it'll be an easy thing for people to fall into that trap, because they're thinking Paul Rudd, he's a funny guy. Chris Pratt, he's a funny guy also. So we'll expect this kind of funny ha-ha thing. But then you got to also realize that they've got Michael Douglas in here. Michael Douglas isn't known for comedy. Dude's a serious actor. So definitely kind of remember that. So, yeah. But yeah, I'm excited for Ant-Man. But we won't touch the post-convergence, post-Secret Wars stuff. We're going to just jump into the major topics. We'll probably have another... I mean, convergence and Secret Wars, that all that stuff is going to be worked out later on within, you know, October, November time. So there's plenty of time to touch that stuff. We're just going to hop into the major topics.
Yeah, so today I guess we'll talk a bit about what a pilgrimage is, because you've been reading Wilson's blog post. He's on a Spider-Verse pilgrimage at the moment, and so major word in homicidal dictionary. So we wanted to make sure that all our readers and listeners are fully in tune with what the pilgrimage is, and hopefully we can inspire some of you guys to take up one or two yourselves and, you know, really read comics at a critical level.
For sure. So, a pilgrimage. The first I'm going to say to define what it is by giving you an example of what it is not. So it is not a binge. Like, it's not you binge watching, say, True Blood to catch up with the season or the series, you know, where you're just kind of like, I'm going to mow down 4 episodes per day to catch up and be current. It's definitely not that, because within binge watching, you'll miss a lot of substance and a lot of essential things for your story, for the story, you know, the worth of the story. So that's not what, so a pilgrimage is not equal to a binge. So that's the first thing. What I've learned through my pilgrimage on Spider-Verse is it's, depending on how you're tackling it, and since I'm giving reviews after each issue of Spider-Verse that I've read, it's very, very time consuming, and it's very slow going, but it's not a bad thing that I'm moving at, I'll say, a snail's pace or close to a snail's pace, because it actually forces me to think about just the piece of literature that I have in front of me really, really well, and with a very, very critical eye, as Lou said. Like, you know, we're going to read this with a lot of critical analysis and just working through it on a level of higher, I'll say a level of higher learning, I want to say, or a higher investigative property, I want to say, you know. So I guess the best way for me to break it down is once I finish an issue that's related to Spider-Verse, so my superior Spider-Man issue 32, I believe. That was like the first issue for that kind of introduced the introduced Spider-Verse and everything like that. And it's the issue that had Spock, Spidey Ock. Shout out to our homie Cam for, you know, giving me that shorthand, because I kept on saying Spidey Ock, and then he just said, "Yo, just use Spock." I was like, "Yo, that's clever."
Yeah, that was real clever.
Yeah, the wordplay on that was awesome. So yeah, so it threw Spock into the year 2099, which, for any Spidey fans, they know that 2099, that's where Miguel O'Hara comes from. Miggy, he's Spider-Man 2029.
Doesn't this one also happen like during issue number 19?
Yes, which was actually also dope. So the temporal time stream kind of goes haywire, and Spock gets thrown into 2099 within issue 19. He disappears, and they're like, "Oh crap, what happened?" And, you know, so he shows up. So then, like, issue 32 has a nice little recap. It's like, hey, so, you know, back in issue 19, you know, Peter Parker was disappeared. And, like, this is what happened within that moment when he disappeared. And I was like, oh, that's clever. That's really nice. So Superior Spider-Man 32 opens up to that. And we see, you know, we see Pete trying to figure out where he is. What's happening. So he quickly figures it out, because, you know, Pete, at this point, Spock is Peter Parker with the consciousness of Otto Octavius. You know, Otto Octavius feels as though he is the most superior mental, intellectual being there is, so he's superior. And he figures out that, well, nature abhors a vacuum. So, meaning, if something happens in one timeline, the equal and opposite needs to happen in the other timeline. You know, nature wants to balance things out. So since Miggy is stuck in the current 616, he got thrown into the 616 timeline. The Earth that has Spider-Man 2099, they don't have a Spider-Man right now. So it was just safe to assume that any Spider-Man who gets thrown out of their current timeline will go to 2099. So it's like, that's where Pete is now. And he figures that out. And I'm reading through this, and like the first time I read through it, I'm like, okay, cool. You know, he goes through this whole thing, and he's just there, and he has some adventures and whatever. And I'm like, all right, cool. When I read it the second time for the pilgrimage, I'm like looking at it very, very critically. So there's a point where, so within the Superior Spider-Man run, and this is, you know, where everything is kind of going to with the whole critical reading, Pete Spock really has this relationship, that's this budding romance with his tutor. Her name is Anna Marconi, and Anna Marconi is this really smart, super What would you say? She's very smart. She's very assertive, right? You say she's really assertive, right, Lou?
She knows how to handle herself. She's really straightforward, strong character.
Yeah. Strong character, yes. A very strong female character. And she's strong not because she's female. That's another thing that I really like with Anna. It's like, she's strong not because she's female. She's just strong because she's strong. Like, she's just dope. It's not like when they wrote her, Dan Slott wrote her in as a character, he was like, well, I'm going to make her strong because she's a girl. I'm just going to make her strong because she's just dope. So there's a budding romance with Pete and Anna, you know, Spock and Anna, really, since Pete kind of still is in love with Mary Jane. He's always going to be in love with MJ. But right now, since Otto is inhabiting his mind, he's in love with Anna. And he gets to the 2099 world, and they have these in that world, they have these holographic agents, these like hollow age, right, that kind of pop up from your watch, and they're kind of like a very super advanced Siri. You know, they do everything for you. They can search the web, they can set your appointments, they can just do book you flights and all that stuff, right? And they have like a factory default setting where it's like, all right, cool. It's just a regular guy, not anatomically correct, just this person. You know, it just looks like a mannequin, right? And Miguel's brother kind of is like explaining this to Spock, and he's saying, yeah, so these are your hollow agents, and they do everything. You can set them to any kind of personal preference that you like, and, you know, but this guy got reset to the factory model. And Spock is like, okay, that's cool. I don't really care about any, you know, it's a trivial thing. I don't really care about personal images on this hollow agent. I really don't care about it. And then like a couple
pages
later. Yeah, a couple pages later, you look at his hollow agent, and, you know, he's modeled his hollow agent in the image of Anna Marconi, and I'm like, wait, oh, yeah, snap. Yeah,
question about that. Why why a little girl version of her, though? That's what confused me.
You know, I don't know why it's a little girl version of her. I mean, I know that Anna, she's, like, short, you know. She's really short, but I don't know why she's like a little girl version of her. Maybe that's just how the hollow agent is. It's like a proportionality type of thing. But I really wasn't sure why he modeled her as like the tiny girl version.
I don't have as much Spider-Man experience as you do, so I looked and I was like, why is she a little girl, though?
Yeah, because like Anna is really short. Like she's, I guess she's like a dwarf, I guess, or is that the proper term? I don't know. I guess she suffers from dwarfism, or if I don't know if it's an affliction or not.
Proper term, but yeah, she's short.
Yeah, she's short. She's super short.
On the exterior, but on the inside, she's 10 foot tall.
Yes, exactly. You know, she's mighty. So, and I'm like, oh, snap, here's Otto, you know, like being this super sentimental guy, like on the outside. He's this pompous, arrogant person where it's like, oh, I don't care about the trivial things such as, you know, personalizing my hollow agent. But then a few panels later, just kind of, I'll say subconsciously, he, you know, models this person after his girlfriend. I'm like, oh, and I totally missed it. I totally missed this the first time I read through Superior Spider-Man, because I was kind of binging Superior Spider-Man until I had to read it again as a part of the Spider-Verse pilgrimage. I'm like, why did I not catch this? So that's just one point on what a pilgrimage is in comparison to, say, another thing. Like, you're looking at this at a very critical, on a very critical level, you know? So if you need to read it 2-3 times to catch everything, do it, because it's going to be worthwhile. You'll come out with a greater appreciation for the characters.
Yeah, so he'll actually get back to that, because after I give my spiel on what a pilgrimage is, he's going more into his Spider-Verse pilgrimage, and I'll give you some insight on mine. But You know, since pilgrimage was sort of my add to the homicidal dictionary, because we all come up with terms that sort of get added, it actually came with sort of the way I got into comic books. So my first pilgrimage is, they've all seen Alyssa's got a super duper long compilation of pretty much every post-crisis pre-52 Batman storyline collected together. And that's sort of because I came into comics during Final Crisis, which is sort of a universe-binding event. But I came into it wanting to know a bit more about Batman, because it also happened around the same time as Batman Rest in Peace. And it was followed up by the Battle for the Cowl and Return of Bruce Wayne. So you've got all these elements of the Bat family intertwined, and seeing who's going to put on this cowl next, what are we going to do in Bruce Wayne's absence. And I just really wanted to know my background. So this is me getting the comics in general. So while I'm developing a pull list, there's also this Retread list that I'm developing that's getting ever expensive, because there's not really one story to give you the level of depth that all these characters play. So I know first I jumped back to Batman Year One, which is still one of my favorite graphic novels to this day, and started giving me some perspective on Batman. And then, since, you know, I'm reading about a dead man, I had to jump around and get information on everybody else involved. And, you know, I read critically a little bit more fluent than most people in general. And I'll be reading.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'll be reading something and, like, mid page, I'll stop and say, wait, that don't make sense. Or, ah, now I get that, because it's very second nature to me for some reason. So I remember reading it, and the first time I realized I needed to slow down was during Death of the Family or Under the Red Hood. It was in my Jason Todd portion of the pilgrimage. I just remember, like, reading Under the Red Hood, knowing at the end this guy was going to take off his mask and be Jason Todd, but I had to read it like I didn't know that to see how well written a story it was and how much it really picks at Bruce Wayne, Jason Todd, and the relationship they shared both as Robin and moving forward. And I was like, maybe I should stop plowing through these, you know, and make this a returning experience and read these all as if I don't know about the present. And, you know, that's sort of how the pilgrimage was born. I started reading a lot of Batman really critically. And, you know, even though Stone reads a lot of Batman, you know, we have two completely different perspectives. And that's because my entire breadth of Batman knowledge came from, like, this really critical reading period at the start of my comics life. And, you know, since, when I wanted to know more about a character, I started calling it a pilgrimage, because, you know, a religious pilgrimage is a return to where your spiritual beginnings, the beginnings of your land. You know, we're returning to this period that defines either a universe moving forward or a character moving forward, and we're doing it with a critical eye so that we can see the way all the pieces in this world sort of play into each other and play together. So, yeah, that's sort of where the pilgrimage was born.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, and so what we'd suggest for you to do is, you know, if it's at all, and it's always financial feasibility when it comes to just reading comics, you know, if you're going to learn anything about a character, if you want to jump into a character or even an event or a group of characters or whatever, and you're like, well, I don't really know where to start because this is my first time getting into comics and I'm just confused because there are years and years and years, decades upon decades of stories, and it's like, well, what's a good thing to do? Find, you know, first thing is you find a good comic book shop, or find somebody who's, you know, who you may know that that reads comics, or even just do a quick Google search. But once you kind of identify your character that you want to learn more about, so if you want to like learn more about Daredevil, since you probably watched the TV show and you're like, oh, he's awesome, now I want to actually, you know, do something, a proper pilgrimage would be to, you know, find out what seminal pieces of Daredevil are out there. So like Frank Miller's run on Daredevil is seminal, you know, Mark Waid's run on Daredevil is a great piece, stuff like that. And then you kind of like think, all right, cool, how do I get these books? Maybe you go to the library, or maybe you order it online, or you go to a comic book shop, and then you actually start reading it really critical. You know, you read it in a sense where it's like, all right, cool, I want to learn almost everything about this character. What makes this guy tick? What makes him do the things that he does, you know, every day, basically? So if I don't vibe with it after the first trade paperback, I'm not going to continue it. You know what I mean? You don't want to waste your time or money. So, and the best way to do that is to critically read these characters, you know, kind of read the story, because, I mean, of course, they're fictional, obviously. Duh, they're fictional. So the story has to be interesting and fun and make some kind of sense, though. You know, you want something that's tightly woven versus just kind of a loose, you know, amalgam of kind of prose and tropes. You want something that's good. So yeah, so for me, you know, I'd say if you're going to learn anything new about a person within the comics world, it's best to do a pilgrimage versus just sort of binging on them, or, you know, potentially say doing a wiki download type of thing where you just kind of like go to wiki and just read all all the stuff that somebody, a group of people, have put on Wikipedia. Wikipedia is definitely a great source, but you get a lot that's left out, you know. Yeah. There's a lot to be desired versus just going to the source material and actually reading it and saying, okay, well, this is what Miller was trying to do here in The Man Without Fear, you know.
Wiki might actually even be a good starting point, because normally they break down the sections into comic lines.
Right, yeah.
So, like, you pull up the wiki page and say, okay, there was a whole sub headline on Man Without Fear, so maybe mm-hmm. that should be what I go pick up next. Oh yeah, probably something else you should note is it's going to slow down your pull list a bit. You know, comic readers, yes, we like to be in a bunch of different stories at once, so it requires you to pull back and really focus in on one story. So absolutely, you can still read other comics, but, you know, depending, when we do it in a group, we have sort of discussions on when we think you're spreading yourself too thin to really get mm-hmm. the full analysis of the pilgrimage. You know, our new recruit, Nie, who's sort of like my comic world Padawan, is on a Miles Morales pilgrimage right now. And, you know, before he picks something out, he'll, like, ask our group, and he'll say, you think this is too big to tackle with me and my pilgrimage now? Because, you know, I'm really feeling like I'm getting to know Miles, and I want to pull from that, which is a really cool way to approach it.
And what Nie is actually doing is really, it's sort of the more ambitious pilgrimages that we have going on right now. Because I'm doing a Spider-Verse thing, and I'll be doing, say, a year long, or maybe even a year and a half long type of pilgrimage, because I'll be stringing pilgrimages together, you know, Spider-Verse, Nightwing, Milestone, and so on and so forth. But Nie is going to tackle the whole Ultimate Universe, so the whole Marvel Ultimate Universe, so 1610, that Earth 1610, which is, you know, that's a thing in and of itself. Like, he's going to tackle all of that, so that we're thinking, you know, Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate Fantastic Four, Ultimate X-Men, all that. And I applaud him for that, because I don't want to do that.
Yeah, he's sort of, since he's doing the group, he's sort of tackled everything advice-wise we've given him, because he's pretty fresh to comics in general. He's sort of taken and jumped in headstrong. Yeah. Even the listing, because what I did on my Batman pilgrimage is I compiled a list, which is like 68 storylines deep, roughly. And I was like, you know, you might want to start compiling this list so the next person who wants to go on the same type of pilgrimage you went on, you can go and say, here's the important stories. You can read out the crappy stuff. And he's even done a good job at, like, he showed us where he's at in his list a minute ago. And
yeah,
he's at a pretty good spot in that, too.
Yeah, he's at a very good spot, especially with Miles Morales. There's a lot of just great arcs that he's saying, these are the ones that you should focus on. Which, you know, and it helps, because anybody else who comes after is like, oh, I want to learn more about Miles Morales, because, you know, he seems cool. Well, here, Nie has you set up really well. Just read these things and come back to us, you know what I mean? It's like, dope. And I mean, and at some point, that'll kind of just me walking through the Spider-Verse pilgrimage. It's really just an event arc that I'm walking through, you know, to help people kind of figure out, well, why, say, Spider-Gwen is such a big deal. Or, you know, why Kane is such an awesome character. So that's the other thing. A lot of people, Kane's my favorite non-Peter Parker Spider-Man. And a lot of people were like, well, what's so awesome about Kane? You'll figure that out through just, you know, Spider-Verse. So, yeah, it's just, that's one of those things. When you run your when you start your pilgrimage, the first thing you do is, you know, definitely figure out the seminal pieces, the things that are most important to the character. Go with that. Now, there are definitely going to be pieces that runs on the character that were like lackluster. And those are definitely a part of the character's history, you know, no doubt. But people will tell you about those. they're definitely going to be, you'll never have a shortage of people saying, oh, Spider-Man sucks because remember back in the 80s and the 90s, that clone saga thing? That was whack. That's why he's lame. So it's like, you don't really have to read those stories because you're going to always have somebody who's, you know, who's going to be an objector of whatever character that you like, and they're going to point at the lame runs, and you're like, okay, yeah, cool. So I can just get the reason why this person is lame from somebody who doesn't like the person. All right, awesome. So let me just focus on the things that made this person a great character, and I'll read that.
Yeah, think.
Wait,
what?
No, so I was saying, so on that side, you know, I think we can probably loop right into the Spider-Verse pilgrimage that I'm on right now.
That's where I was at too, so we're good.
Sweet, perfect segue. That's the new little bridge from Pacific Rim right there. That's what that is. You know, we got to fight the kaiju. That's how we fight the kaijus. But yeah, so we kind of nerd powered up on y'all right there. Sorry about that. But so I'm doing the Spider-Verse pilgrimage, and as I said, it hasn't been tough sledding. It's been a slow moving process because I want to get this right. You know, I definitely want to make sure that I'm reading this with a very inquisitive and critical eye, because I actually started reading it while it was current, and I was like, I can actually do a pilgrimage on this and just wait until it ends and then see what happens from there. And I mean, this was prior to knowing that Marvel was going to throw out this Secret Wars thing, and then the whole Marvel universe is going to be not the same ever again. Like, the Ultimate Universe is destroyed. That's what's going to basically happen. And, you know, the 616 isn't really going to be the 616 as we know it, because just out the back end of, you know, Secret Wars, there's going to be this brand new, all new, all different Marvel. So for me, I just thought, well, Spider-Verse, you know, when I was initially reading Spider-Verse as it came out as an ongoing, I was like, okay, this is going to be cool. We're going to learn about some different spiders. What are the major threats to the Spider-Verse in its sense? And then I was like, okay, well, it's definitely pilgrimage worthy. And I kind of touched on Superior Spider-Man already, just in my what I think of pilgrimages. So Superior Spider-Man 32 starts off the Spider-Verse event arc that Dan Slott, you know, had going. And, you know, it's basically when Doc Ock, Spidey Ock, basically gets thrown into the 2099 timeline, and a bunch of craziness happens. And within that, though, he's being pursued. He's within that, while he's trying to get back to Earth 616, he hits different alternate universes, alternate timelines, and he sees these different spiders just dead. Like, there's a universe where Spider-Man is a part of the Fantastic Four and he's dead. There's a universe where the Superhero Registration Act is a thing, and the Iron Spider, which I'm thinking it might be Amadeus.
It could be Amadeus, it could be Pete, because the armor was made.
The armor, yeah. During
the Civil War.
Right, yeah. So there's a future where, you know, the Superhero Registration Act is a thing, like, and he's dead. That Spider-Man's dead. And there's another future where Magneto rules, like, the House of M timeline, I'm assuming, you know, and that spider is also dead. Yeah,
whoa, wait, were those all Marvel events? Mind blown.
Right?
Mind
blown. Exactly. And and he's dead. So they're like all these different futures, not futures, all these different timelines, and, you know, all the spiders in those timelines are dead, and they have this distinct two stab wounds in their chest, right? A very distinct weapon. And, you know, Spock is a scientist, and, you know, once is chance, twice is coincidence, three times is a pattern. So he's like, I need to investigate this a little bit further. And he starts jumping to different timelines. And, you know, there's a timeline where Spider-Man is a Middle Eastern guy. He's from India. And, you know, he's being pursued by this spider hunter looking guy that's a total badass. Like, he's a G. I can't put it any other way. And he goes in, and Spock saves him. And, you know, and, like, we find out that he's recruiting a bunch of other spiders because he's trying to battle this guy. And so there's another timeline, though, where Spidey is a friggin' assassin. Like, he is a killer. He's training with Wolverine, right? No joke, he uses guns. And I was like, oh, snap, this is a darker, you know, more just ruthless Pete. And so the guy who's hunting them within Spider-Verse, you know, if you've read Spider-Verse already to the completion, you know his name is Karn. He's a spider slayer. His family, he comes from a long line of spider slayers, and this is what they do. They eat spiders. They eat spider totems, to be exact. But this guy Karn, right? At the moment, we don't really know his name. So, and in this timeline, Pete and Logan, they're like super best friends, basically. Logan is his sensei, I would say. The dude kills Logan. Like, he kills Logan. Like, he just he vaporizes him completely. I didn't know Logan can die, but in this timeline, this guy kills Logan. So we're kind of looking at this power levels right there, you know what I mean? And I was like, oh, snap, this dude is awesome, like, in terms of power. So I can see why there, you know, why Spock is, you know, amassing these other spider totems to stop this crazy behind threat. Now, that's just a real quick and dirty rundown of what's happening with the Spider-Verse. The pilgrimage version of the Spider-Verse that I'm on, what it's been showing me initially is just how great of a character evolution that Otto Octavius has gone through. So, like we said in the hot, like I said in the hot, in the quick topics, you know, there'll probably be a generation of kids who won't even think that Otto Octavius was a bad guy. He'll just kind of be Superior Spider-Man, you know, like he was redeeming himself and whatever. Within this early stage of Spider-Verse, it's really focused on him, where it's like, here's Otto being very altruistic, I'll say, even though at the core of his altruism, there's self-preservation, where he's like, he's collecting these other spiders to, yes, protect them, but also to protect himself, because, you know, he knows that he can't take on this huge threat alone, so he's going to create a team, an army. But it's like, this guy's actually going out of his way right now to, like, save these other spiders so that he can also be saved, versus saying, well, let me just kind of go to the lab and figure out a solution that will prevent this guy from coming to Earth 616 and wrecking shit there. You know what I mean? I'm gonna go save these other people, and we're gonna kind of create this army to combat, you know, whatever else is to come.
The great web calls.
Exactly, yeah, the great web calls. It's like, yo, it's like, let's do that. And so that's like Superior Spider-Man 32, you know, here's amassing some people. And then in Edge of Spider-Verse number one, we're introduced to Spider-Man Noir. So this is a late 30s, early 1940s area. And, you know, Pete and all that stuff. Pete basically has this badass, all black getup, and he has a six shooter, which I kind of thought was him being ruthless, but it's mostly a sign of the times. Like, everybody kind of had a gun back then.
Yeah. Film noir is actually a whole genre of film.
Yeah.
You know, that's where you get your Humphrey Bogart movies.
Exactly.
And things like Casablanca and the Maltese Falcon. So, Spider-Man noir tries to pull a lot of those elements. So, gives you something very modern in a very old school setting. And those are the type of things that happen, you know. Six shooters is the best gun we got out here.
So that's what we're gonna use. Exactly. So yeah, so Spider-Man Noir, you know, that's what he's doing. And one of the coolest things about Spider-Man Noir is that, so the main antagonist in it is Mysterio. And I mean, anybody who's familiar with Spider-Man, they know that Mysterio is a special effects guy. You know, that's kind of his 616, Quentin Beck 616 is, you know, is the special effects guy. In Spider-Man Noir, he's a magician, right? Because it's kind of, there's no really special effects, because they don't have, you know, special effects in cinema or whatever. And I was like, he fits so much better as a magician than a special effects guy. I was like, this is an awesome Quentin Beck. Like, he should be a magician. He's just dope as a magician. As a magician, he's smooth. He's debonair. You know, he's just classy. but he's the villain. I'm like, I like this Quentin Beck. I can get behind this Quentin Beck. He's awesome. So, you know, we go through Edge of Spider-Verse number one. And, you know, Pete, Spider-Man, and all that stuff, and he's going through some stuff. Aunt May in Edge of Spider-Verse number one is also very cool. She's very witty. She still doesn't like Spider-Man, but she's not just this frail old lady who, you know, can't really do anything. They give her a personality, which is awesome. I definitely appreciated that from the creative staff. David Hein is the writer, by the way, and I'm definitely digging how he did it. They also give MJ a very dark background, like a very dark past. So apparently while Pete was at school in college, I don't know how he got away from the war or whatever, but he's studying. So apparently while he was studying and taking exams, MJ was like fighting in a war, like whatever war, you know, they're saying is back then, whatever is equivalent to World War II in the Spider-Man noir world. And I'm like, oh snap, she's got stuff that she can't talk about. So that might be really cool if they ever, you know, address it any time further in the future. So I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Definitely digging how they're giving MJ some depth, you know, which MJ always had depth, even in 616. You know, she owns her own nightclub. She's a model. She does stuff. That's really dope. But the other thing that, the one thing I want to point out here in Spider-Man Noir is, so they get a sample of Pete's blood, because apparently in Spider-Man Noir, it's not a radioactive spider, it's a African spider that got smuggled over when the goblin stole these statues from Africa. So Spider-Man, in essence, has been endowed with the power of a Nancy, which was really dope. I was like, oh snap, African folklore, let's go, this is awesome, they're doing some cool stuff here. So, you know, so Mysterio wanted a sample of Pete's blood so he can be endowed with the power of a Nancy, and then he wants to run the, you know, the underworld, take it away from Wilson Fisk. So, you know, Pete kind of gets caught in this little trick that this trap that Mysterio had for him, but he figures it out and he gets out. But the sample of Pete's blood's been drawn. And a cool thing that happens here is the way they got to Pete was they kidnapped Felicia Hardy. You know, it's one of Pete's love interests. It's sort of like it's really interesting that no matter the timeline, Pete's either going to be connected with MJ, Felicia, or Gwen. It's really funny. It's like, no matter what timeline you're in, one of these three girls will be your wife or your love interest. So just kind of get used to it, dude. But so like they kidnap Felicia and they use her to bring Pete in to the mix, right? But like he gets away within the confusion. The Karn, the Spider Slayer, he shows up, and within that confusion, Felicia slips away with Pete's blood. So I'm like, oh, this should be interesting. Is she going to use the blood on herself? Is she going to, like, sell it to the highest bidder? What's going to happen here? So, you know, that's Edge of Spider-Verse number one right there. It's really interesting. Now, one of the funniest things, though, is once Spock hops in and saves, you know, Spidey Noir, he pulls them back to home base, which is Earth 2099. That's where they're kind of regrouping and everything like that. And he has a really, really clever line. he gives Pete a quick rundown on what happened in the future. You know what I mean? And he's like, yeah, so the Nazis lost. We have TV and all this other stuff. And then he's like, there's a homicidal maniac who's trying to kill us. So I called a meeting and I'm like, oh, you're like really clever. Just nice way of downplaying what's happening, you know, with this whole homicidal maniac. I call this meeting to let you know that we need help. Now, Edge of Spider-Verse number two, which I finished a couple days ago. Once I said this is really slow moving type of thing, I'm trying to make sure I got everything because I'm doing reviews on this, is Spider-Gwen. Spider-Gwen is so awesome.
One of my favorite comics of 2014. I think I wrote one of like my first post about that. Like that was... Yes. A one-shot issue if I ever seen it.
Yes. Spider-Gwen is so freaking awesome. Like, and I read Spider-Gwen around the same time that Lou read Spider-Gwen. And I was like, yo, she really is awesome. Then reading her again, I'm like, oh my God, she is so fantastic. This is one of the things where I really love the pilgrimage. Because there's a part in Spider-Gwen where, and I'll kind of walk through it sort of kind of page by page, but this is a really prime example and it stuck with me while I've been rereading it. So there's a part where she's talking to her dad and she's basically talking to him about life and trying to figure out what she wants to do in life. So she's like, hey dad, you know, I'm not really sure what's going on. I love music. I have to pick a major, but I really love music. I'd love to do that. So it's sort of like she's having this conversation with Captain Stacy, but it's really more so she's having a conversation with him about choosing to do something that you love, even if it's not totally understandable by everyone. So it's sort of like she wants to be Spider-Woman, but obviously nobody likes Spider-Woman because she's public enemy number one. Because it's in Gwen, in this timeline, Earth 65, you know, Gwen is Spider-Woman, Peter Parker dies. He uses the serum. He turns into a lizard, then he dies. And everybody's like, well, you caused Peter Parker to die, so we have to hunt you. And J. Jonah Jameson is at the head of this, of this whole, let's hunt down Spider-Woman. She's a menace. She's a, she's public enemy number one. She needs to be stopped, as usual. That's another, constant. No matter what universe you're in, J. Jonah Jameson is just always going to hate you if you're a spider. So she's talking to Captain Stacy about this, and Captain Stacy's telling her that, you have to do the things that you love, and you have to figure out where you're most needed. And once you figure that out, then, your life will be a lot more, a lot easier, I guess. Life will make a lot more sense. So within that conversation that she's having with her dad, this very cool family moment, he tells her, hey, I have to go because he's a police captain. He's got to go police captain stuff. And she's about to get on the subway. And there's this beat cop on the subway. And he tells Gwen to freeze, don't move. He's about to arrest her. And she's like, well, of course she's not going to freeze, though. No, she's not going to just get arrested. So she basically does some cool spider tricks, parkour stuff. And before she does that, she notices that he's super nervous. Like, he is beyond scared. He's shaking like a leaf, her exact words. And he starts to fire at her. I think he fires like 3 or 4 shots at her. And she's like, yo, he's shooting at me. Like, he's fucking shooting at me. Of course, she can't say it in the comic book. They got the little explicits marked out and all that stuff. And she, she apprehends him. She, disarms him and all that stuff. And, he's like, please don't kill me, because he's afraid of her because he thinks that she's going to kill him. And she's like, I'm not going to kill you. Like, if anything, you're going to kill somebody because you're the one shooting at me in a crowded subway station, right? So throughout this whole thing, right, like this back and forth that she had with this beat cop, and then later on when her dad gets attacked by this hired hitman, who, by the by, he was hired to kill Captain Stacy by Matt Murdock by way of the Kingpin. So in Earth 65, just to let y'all know, in Earth 65, Matt Murdock is a bad guy. Daredevil is bad, and he works for the Kingpin. So, it's sort of like, take every hero that you know or kind of came to know and just flip them. Because that's what's happening here. You know what I mean? So this hired hitman comes after Captain Stacy. Captain Stacy's at Gwen's concert. Gwen's a part of a band. And she shows up, and the hitman shows up. He's giving Captain Stacy the works. She comes in. She starts helping. She starts beating this hitman up. His name is Alexei, hired hitman, and all that stuff. And the biggest point of notice, though, was once she takes care of this hired hitman, Captain Stacy's like, "Yo, stop!
Let don't me move, pause you for one moment."
Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't realize till you said it. Gwen Stacy's on Earth 65.
Yeah.
Year of Gwen Stacy's first comic, Amazing Spider-Man number 31, December 1965.
Yep. Boom. Yeah. Boom. Yep. Mind blown, right? See, Marvel has a great way of doing this, where they just throw Easter eggs in, where it's like, oh, let's see how. So that's, I guess that's the other thing. Like, when you critically read it, and you're just like, wait. They definitely did this on purpose. There's no way this is just accidental. Because it's like, what? So, yeah. So, and it's like, so when Captain Stacy tells her to freeze and all that stuff, there's this where he's like, he's going to put her, he's like, hey, you're going to have to, you're under arrest and all that stuff. Now, so she unmasks and she shows, Captain Stacy that, oh, it's Gwen. This is, I'm your daughter. And she has this very cool monologue. And I'm going to read it word for word because I have the comic in front of me. And she's like, you're a good cop, Dad. You put on that badge and carry that gun because if you don't, someone who shouldn't will. And I was like, wait, old boy who was shooting at her in that crowded subway, he is not fit for this badge or a gun. This is who she's referencing. The first time I read this, I was like, I totally missed that.
I missed that too. You're giving me knowledge right now.
And I was like, oh my God, how did I miss it? And it's like, I was just reading it to enjoy Gwen Stacy as Spider-Woman, but that's what she was saying. So, and then she says, when I put on this mask, I only did it because it freed me from responsibility. I thought I was special, and Peter Parker died because he tried to follow my example. I have to take responsibility for that to make his death mean something, but I can't do it in a jail cell. This mask is my badge now. If I don't define what it means, monsters like this, and then she points to the Russian hitman that she just defeated, monsters like this will, this is where I'm needed most. And I was like, this was one of the best examples and reasons for why Pete, Gwen, Miles, Miggy, Kane, Ben Reilly, anybody else puts on the mask. It's like, this was the greatest example where it's like, hey, as a kid who has a dad as a cop who faces danger every day, I mean like every single day, she knows why you have this responsibility. You know, the great power, with great power comes great responsibility, absolutely, but even more so, it's like,
give us
this
the Gwen Stacy version of that quote.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like,
sometimes what we want isn't what the world needs.
Exactly. Sometimes what we want isn't what the world needs. And it's like, that's what it is, like, right there. Because it's like, yo, of course, there are definitely probably times where Captain Stacy is like, you know, I really don't want to go to work today. Really don't want to get shot at by criminals. But the world needs a good cop. And I'm one of the few good cops here. So I got to do this. Because if there were more guys like the dude who was shooting at her in the crowded subway, that's the part where I'm like, yo, you just tried to shoot somebody in a subway with people. Bullets ricochet. Someone could have died. If there were more guys like that, a lot of people are dying. Versus people like Captain Stacy, who was like, you know what? Before I shoot you or even think of shooting you, I'm going to try to arrest you. Because that's what a good cop does. And I was like, oh man, Gwen Stacy is awesome. I can see why Spider-Gwen gets an ongoing series, because it's like, yo, that's dope. And, you know, towards the end, so, you know, Captain Stacy lets her go, because, I mean, yo, she made a very great point, you know what I mean? Like, you can't arrest this girl. One, she's your daughter, true, but two, you know, she gives you this very strong argument that, yo, I'm needed most as Spider-Woman, and I gotta do this. You feel me? And Edge of Spider-Verse number 2 is one of the few, is the first issue that doesn't have Spot come in and save somebody, because, you know, shoot, Gwen can handle herself. It's the best way to put it. She can handle herself. But they have Spider-Man from the UK, you know, like this British Spider-Man, and he's kind of like the lookout. So the thing that I realized there, once again, through the critical reading, is at this point, Spock has amassed a large enough party that he can send out basically recon soldiers, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. Like, he could send out guys for reconnaissance. So he isn't doing the recruiting himself now. He's actually sending out his, you know, his advanced team. And I got this on a second read. I was like, oh, the first read, I was like, okay, cool. There's this British Spider-Man, so I guess we're going to learn about him soon. I didn't realize it was just actually really, you know, Spock just being a great field general, where it's like, oh, snap. And another thing just came to me. Look at that. Look at that. This is how the field vision works. So a Superior Spider-Man, instead of doing his patrol rounds himself, Spock created spider bots. And sure, they got hacked by the Goblin, and you know that's how it, and that's how Goblin Nation got created. But Spock, yeah. But Spock, ever the scientist and ever the engineer, also wanted to, you know, make his processes as efficient as possible. So he created these spider bots to do patrol for him. And here he is doing the same thing again. Because classic Peter Parker would probably recruit everybody by himself, one by one. Peter Parker with Otto Octavius' conscience? Not so much. I'm going to let other people do some work, too.
Yeah. Other stuff to point in that comic, that was when it was a one-shot in every sense of the word, it was a really good issue. Everything in that comic had reading once you read it critically. First of all, how much the music was part of her life. Like, she didn't just like drumming, it was part of her. You know, instead of Peter Parker's short wrestling career, the Spider-Woman was a drummer. And
right.
She's part of Mary Jane Watson's band called the Mary Janes, and they're practicing at the beginning, and they're singing the song Face It Tiger, which, by the way, the issue was, like, so powerful, an all-girl rock band
right
went out and performed the song and then performed it at Comic-Con. But the art is really good, and it ties the drumming to her life very well without any words. They're singing the song, and Face It Tiger, Tiger being a reference to what Mary Jane calls Peter Parker, but also to Gwen having to face this decision in her life that's coming up pretty much throughout the issue that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And the panels also move through the story very organically. Like, you can see how the person gets from the position they're in one panel to the position in the next panel. The flashbacks also kind of uniquely happen with the transition being Gwen's thought. Like, you won't change the page and then you're a flashback. She's playing the drums and a tear drops from her eyes, and the next thing you know, we're jumping back to what the heck just bit me, and we see the Peter Parker flashback. You know, it happens really organically. And then once she starts doing that, she hits the drums, and then, like, the duns from the drums get bigger because she's getting really intense. And the issue is just as well put together visually as it is writing, you know? We're, you know, along the writer-editor line, so we always talk about the written parts of it, but this was just as much visually put together as well as it was written. You know, even the thought they put into her costume
totally
is wild. You know, she wears primary colors like Spider-Man always does, but they accent the black and white, which is really Gwen. And she puts paint over her eyes where it really glares and clashes with the rest of the white, and it all really fits the punk drummer attitude, and it's all just Gwen. And it was all Gwen's book. It told a really full story, and the pictures are pretty to look at, as well as the bubbles easy to read. So it was just a really good issue.
Yeah, totally. And Robbie Rodriguez and Rico Renzi, he's the artist, and Rico Renzi, he's the colorist. They did a great job on this book. Like, Jason Latorre told a great story. It was definitely an awesome setup, but it was basically a perfect alchemy of art meeting, you know, story. And it's like, this thing is just visually pleasing to look at. It's like, wow. It's like very authentic piece of art. Because the other thing is, looking at it in that critical sense, you see Glory's hairstyle, and it's not, her hair is like a little disheveled because they've been rehearsing for a while. You know, you've got like stray hairs here and there. It's not perfectly manicured and blow dried. You know what I mean? They seem like college students where it's like, yo, I'm coming from class, I'm coming from bio, and we have this rehearsal at 5:30. Ain't really much time for me to, you know, comb this out. Let's get this done. Let's go to dinner type of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. All really awesomely tied. So.
Yeah. So it was definitely awesome. And then there's a panel there that has this very cool juxtaposition, very cool irony, where there's Gwen in her thoughts on top of this billboard that says "Stop Spider-Woman, call 555-4-PETE, cash some reward." And it's like, oh, look at this. This is the billboard that's supposed to be stopping her. And this is where she's thinking about all her Spider-Woman stuff. And I was like, that's just clever.
Oh, yeah, that's something else that I don't think we mentioned. The world also, it's not just Gwen's personal guilt that Peter Parker died and it's her fault. Like, the world knows that it's Spider-Gwen's fault. Like, they may not know how it was her fault, but the world's general opinion is, like, Peter Parker is dead because of this mass vigilante.
Right. So, you know, and that's a different, that's a great point. That's the thing where is she's different in that sense than, say, Peter himself, where it's like his guilt is just that he didn't help when he had the power to. Nobody knows, you know, that it's his fault that Uncle Ben dies. Nobody knows that. It's just like, whatever. Just like the other things, like, nobody knows that it's his fault that, you know, that Gwen dies and she snaps her neck. It's just like, hey, he knows it, so that's all he needs. But everybody else here knows, like, yo, he's dead because of you, lady. Like, we saw it. We saw the building fall on the kid, and you were there. So, yeah. This on you, girl.
Not to mention his last words were, I just wanted to be special. Like you.
It's like, damn. You're like, oh, man. So, yeah, she's going through this. And it's like, oh, wow. But, yeah, like you said, Lou, this is completely Gwen-like. And it really is. There's, like, no part of it that, there's no part of it that makes you think, oh, yeah, this is, like, you know, a Gwen version of Pete. This is just all Gwen Stacy. Like, this is Gwen Stacy being Gwen Stacy when she's alive. Like, and that was fantastic.
Yeah.
So yeah. We're both selling high on Spider-Gwen, just in case anybody hasn't noticed. We're selling high on her. She's the real deal, y'all.
And by the way, they do call her Spider-Woman in a comic book, because I had a conversation with somebody who was like, that's dumb. Why doesn't everybody know who she is? Well, we already have a book titled Spider-Woman, and this is Gwen, so we call the book Spider-Gwen. Just in case that was anybody's hang-up, because it shouldn't be your hang-up.
Right, yeah, because it's, you know, it's Gwen Stacy Spider-Woman, but since there's already a Spider-Woman, her name is Jessica, we just say Spider-Gwen, so cool. Yeah, man, it's just like, oh, man. So, yeah. Let's jump on. We're going to jump to sort of kind of your pilgrimage going on with Sandman, right?
Yeah, so my pilgrimage started out simply as me reading Neil Gaiman's Sandman, because Sandman is critically acclaimed all over the place, and Neil Gaiman won the World Fantasy Award for Sandman number 19, and all the writers of novels were like, that's not fair, comic books shouldn't be able to win, that's horrible. So this issue was so good, it won a World Fantasy Award, and authors of novels complain so much that it will never happen again. You know, he's the reason for a rule.
The Neil Gaiman rule,
And one of the most acclaimed awards in written fantasy. So I was writing high on what made Sandman. Bit of background on Sandman is it was DC initially their attempt at bringing back a Golden or Silver Age character into the modern DC universe as it was in the late 80s, early 90s. But Damon had such a compelling story in his own, like the character he created didn't need to be the guy that was a superhero in a Sandman. So it sort of like branched off into being its own thing, being one of the books they started the Vertigo line with, because what he ended up writing was just so completely different and so unique standing on its own. He didn't need the rest of the superhero universe, and they kind of acknowledged that early on and left him to his devices. What makes this pilgrimage just sort of unique is how I've sort of been coinciding this with my introduction into novels in general, because if you would have tried to catch me a month ago, I would have been like, I don't read books with pictures unless they're philosophy texts, and the cool thing about philosophy texts is they're stories, and I can work through that as slow as I want. They're not really something with a beginning and end. They're these separate things that you're supposed to dwell on. So, I have a friend, and I probably have spouted this out before just because it seems like something I would have spouted before, where I was like, you know, she reads. So I was like, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll start reading books without pictures the day you pick up a comic book.
Mm-hmm. And I remember this.
Yeah, so I was going through a couple comics that she would read to start, and a couple things that would be good without getting too deep too fast, because, you know, I sort of do that all the time, so I needed stuff that could stand alone, but are good examples of the synergy that is the medium of comic books. So somewhere on that list was Sandman. And one day I get a text that's like, I'm at the bookstore picking up volume one of Sandman. And I was like, oh crap, that means I have to read a book. I never, never expected that to get real. Darn it. So I was only three issues into Sandman at the time. And so what we got with her starting comics and me starting novels was a really good exchange. So I figured I'd step back my three issues and we'd read together. So the first book I picked up, which I finished, was Stardust by Neil Gaiman, which she had read, which is like a teen book, but that's good for me to start because, again, I haven't read a full book with pictures since, like, high school. So, and it's the same author, so there was a really good level of compare and contrast. And, yeah,
definitely.
You know, as any of the other members of the Comicidal crew will tell you, I have this love for storytelling in general. Well, comics so happens to be probably my favorite medium, but I watch a ton of movies, too. I watch TV shows, and what different mediums are good at doing when they tell stories and what components make up a good story were always really important to me. So this is me taking a dive into the one medium I sort of shied away from because you don't really read it the same way. In fact, if I can get my pilgrimage partner to ever hop on one of these mics one time, that would actually probably be a pretty good conversation. But so from a book novel standpoint, it's interesting to talk about it from a book novel standpoint and then from what Sandman is as a standalone comic. But from a book novel standpoint, it was really cool because at the beginning, you know, I read issues one and two of Sandman, same time I read issues one and two of Stardust. And so we have our conversation about it and I'm talking first and I was like, books are so crappy because with a comic book and with movies and every other form of media that I have is normally really visual, you get the whole picture at once. So I'm sitting here reading like one sentence and trying to imagine a whole world from that one sentence. And then, you know, you read two sentences down and it's like, here's this village. Ah, I already imagined a village in my brain. And on this village, there's a wall. Wait, there was no wall in my brain. I have to go back and revise. And to the south, there's a forest. Darn, now there's a forest. I'm doing it wrong again. This sucks. And, you know, I sort of got the push through the end of the paragraph and then put your picture together. And I was like, oh, I get it. That makes sense. And then even after I do that, how my mind resolves that is, it's like I'm playing a first-person shooter and I'm only looking at what they tell me to look at. So instead of imagining a whole village, I'm imagining the house we're talking about. And now it's like, look over there and there's a wall. And now it's just like I moved my right analog stick a little bit and now I can see the wall.
Right.
And so then she's describing a comic book's, her first comic reading. And no, I had her go read Sandman number one again because there's little things that you wouldn't know to pick up on as a comic reader. Like the entire issue number one, the protagonist's dream, or, you know, he's got many names. I'm going to go with Dream or Morpheus because those are the two I use the most interchangeably, is trapped in this glass orb the whole time. And I was trying to figure out whether in the first issue everything was narration, because Gaiman does narrate in the early issues of Sandman because I think he's still learning the comic medium himself. Or if they were thought bubbles. And I was like, one of the things that made me think that they were thought bubbles and he still had some visual of the realm of dreams outside is that one of the characters who was dreaming was reading through the looking glass. So, you know, one of the Wonderland stories. And I was like, she was like, where did you see they were doing that? I was like, yeah, comics, you got to look at the whole picture, too. It's a panning camera, but most of the stuff in that camera is important. Mm-hmm. So there's been that interesting back and forth dynamic that, you know, sort of got me through the book, because contrasting it with how comics are read directly through conversation sort of gets me to how I should be attacking reading a novel like a different animal. And as analytical as my brain is, I can't go sentence by sentence this time because that's not how this one is supposed to work. And so that's been a really interesting thing plowing through.
Yeah, for sure.
And then Sandman itself and something else that just came out of the whole other medium pilgrimage is reading a novel by Neil Gaiman. You understand that a lot of the stuff that was sloppy in the first volume of Sandman was a bit of growing pains, because he'd written one or two like British sci-fi comics before, or one or two stories for DC before, but he had never done an ongoing at that point.
Right.
So a lot of things he were doing were like novelistic things, and, you know, for my friend who she was transitioning from novels, stuff I felt like was hand-holding was stuff that she is used to because she reads books, so it was really good transition for her, but I'm sitting there like, why is this guy telling me how the room smells?
Right.
It doesn't add to the story. Like, I can just look at Morpheus, make a face, and I know that the room smells unpleasant to him. Like, I don't need my hand held all the way through the comic.
Yeah.
But that was Gaiman transitioning into the medium and, you know, building chemistry with his artists. He had a penciler for the first couple issues, or through most of volume one, not all of volume one, where the guy is, I don't think, the best visual storyteller. You know, the way you move through panels didn't seem organic. So you turn a page, and while the text is easy for somebody who's new to read, the other aspects of comics, like your transition from panel to panel and the order you're supposed to be reading, is going to be hard, even with the extra hand-holding. And Sam Keith, who is a writer and an artist, and normally, I think writers slash artists normally lack some in one than the other. And, you know, the reason comics are such good organic pieces is because your writer, your penciler, your colorist, and your letterer all work really well together in creating this great vision. So, yeah, Sam Keith topped off voluntarily of the book. And I actually think that was good, because when Mike Dringenberg jumps on the book, it's an entirely different reading experience, which actually played out interesting in our conversation too, because when I was talking to my friend, I told her that the penciling and the colors were really important. Take note, because there's going to be a penciler change, volume one, and I want you to tell me what issue it happens. So she gets to Sandman issue 6, doesn't even realize it, but she doesn't even realize it consciously, but I know she realized it subconsciously because of how differently enthralled she was with the story. Okay. Like, she was very angry at the issue, and she was full of complaints and full of complaints and passion, and talks about how the antagonist of the storyline is a jerk for absolutely no reason, and those were completely livid and violent things he did for no reason. And she was, and I was like, you know, you're so into this comic and I love it, but I think you're into it so much that you missed something. And I had to say it before like 3 times before she's like, oh, is this the one where they changed the penciler? And I was like, it totally was.
Yo.
So, I don't know. It's also been, oddly, a good intro to comic spot that I didn't expect it to be. And the world building in this is very interesting. You know, it's pretty, I'm like halfway through volume 2. And it's pretty sloppily done in volume 1, partially due to the penciler, partially, there's like a lot of things going on, partially due to Gaiman getting used to writing comics, partially due to the fact that through volume 1, it was supposed to be part of the mainstream DCU, so there was a chunk of cameos, you know, some were better than others. Issue 3 does Constantine, and you can't really tell that's a forced cameo because Constantine's self-loathing self sort of fit in with this whole theme of dreams and nightmares and the item that Morpheus is looking for at the time sort of fit really organically into the story. Same thing when he goes to hell and meets Etrigan. Okay, yeah, he's a demon from hell, so that makes sense. But, you know, when he goes to the Justice League and they do the whole Martian Manhunter thing, that seemed pretty forced, even though he's very troubled and has a lot to have nightmares about. The same thing with Mr. Miracle was there also, and he has everything to have nightmares about with being raised and tortured by Darkseid and Grandma Goodness. But even to somebody who didn't know, so Eden Hart didn't really know it was a crossover, she was like, those nightmares were very cruel and very random. And I'm sitting there like, yeah, but it was a crossover and they were trying to make sure that they got their Justice League characters in. And it made the issue not really fit.
Gotta get the sales, yo. Another part of it is, you know, at times we have to be self-aware and realize they're still trying to sell, issues, and a good way to sell some issues is to throw in those crossovers. Like, oh yeah, if you haven't checked out Sandman, you might want to check him out now because the Justice League's in there. Martian Manhunter has problems.
Yeah. So, despite eating through all the crud, he establishes like this entire place called the Realm of Dreams. And these 7 or 8, I can't recall if it's him and his 7 siblings, or if there's 7 of them total, immortal creatures who sort of control these different aspects of life. You know, his older sister is death.
I like how death is a woman in this one, too. I always like when they make death a woman for some reason.
Death is actually pretty awesome. She's in the last issue of the volume. And so the first volume, Preludes and Nocturnes, they establish the dream realm. They establish hell. They establish hell with several rulers that sort of correspond with different mythologies, because Dream, the premise of the story is Dream is trapped on Earth for, I believe, 80 years. And he's trapped on Earth by this magical society who was trying to capture death and force death to make them immortal. So when he returns to hell, it's like, ah, we've got Lucifer, the fallen angel here. And when he left, that was all that was in charge of hell. But now there's now there's Beelzebub and somebody else, and it's like, yeah, we kind of split hell into thirds because we all live here now.
Yeah, got roommates.
So that was pretty cool. And he does that between all of that other crap. And, you know, the sixth issue, which was sort of a standalone issue, but it goes into volume. It's grouped in with volume one like they normally do with one or two issue storylines. You know, they sort of stick it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So that it has its fit. That was really good because that was all about Dream, and that was like the first real introspective we got after he's done with like this blind rage he has and this really driven goal he has after being trapped for 80 years. It's like, now let me stop and contemplate what I'm going to do with the rest of eternity now. And when he's sitting there moping, trying to go through sort of this existential crisis, who's there to help him but his older sister, Death. And that story is like two issues, or yes, two issues after the artist change. So the visual storytelling in that is really good. And the introspective on character through several things that aren't just thought really help you with seeing how in this short time span, you know, seven issues is a pretty quick time to adjust to a bunch of things at the, at the writer. You know, side note on issue number eight, I remember we had our gray-skinned black people, you know, before we got the brown color. And they weren't even real characters. They were just in the background. I was like, oh, there goes some gray black people. It'd be so offensive to actually color us our skin color. Cool.
Right.
But,
cool, I see it.
Either way, the whole time he's sort of whining to Big Sister, like, I don't know what to do with my life. Death is sort of walking around, and since she's sort of this 90s fly punk rock girl, she's just going to these places and having conversations with people when people realize, oh, wait, you're Death. And, you know, they're out there making these requests, and she's sitting there helping them come to their terms with the fact that they're dead, but that's it, and they move on. And, you know, her perspective on life, she seems like a very happy person, but she's going through, and pretty much all she sees is sorrow.
Yeah.
And, you know, she talks about her realm and how she lives in a very grim place. She even picks up a baby. Like, that's very grim. Yeah. A mom walks in the room and she comes and she picks up the baby and takes the baby to her realm, and the mom comes back and like, no, my baby's dead. It's broken. And the Dream sitting here like, you know, I'm worried about nightmares and me and what it meant for me to be in this human realm at the time. You know, I just gotta be me and let it fly. And they do it really well. You know, last page of that was kind of really horny, but the evolution of Gaiman as a writer is really seen through this volume and how he's setting up something really good. So, I really like how it's setting up something really different, especially since it was supposed to set up a superhero comic. And going in with that knowledge, you know, puts a lot of things from Volume 1 into perspective. You know, even at the end of Volume 1, the ending's kind of open enough where his decision to what to do with the rest of eternity in the next volume could have been, I'm going to put on a mask and go fight crime in the human realm and be the next Sandman. But that's not the way they decided to go, because, you know, this is sort of one of the early things that pioneer, not for all comics, but for American comics, that superheroes are really a genre. They don't encompass the entire medium.
Right.
And so we start breaking off after that. The first issue of Volume 2 is a prequel to what will be the rest of the volume. And he does a really, really good job. Like, issue number 9 is great, too, at creating mythos. Because what he does, first of all, even when you have an omnipotent narrator in comics, you still normally know who the narrator is.
Right,
it's not a novel, like, there's just this overhanging voice that knows everything. And so he starts off Volume 2 like, hey, this is going to be different because I'm giving you your omnipotent narrator. Like, this is why we know the story. So he goes to this hidden African village. And in this village, there's men and women. And men have their stories. And women have their stories. And their stories don't even really cross. And there's good tribe cautionary tales. And as part of the rite of passage of the male to come to become a man, they sort of walk off, they get circumcised, and they head off into the desert. And whatever elder they go with, it's just the two of them, sits down and it's like, go find it and bring it to me. And when you know, I will tell you a story. This story can only be told once by anybody in our tribe, and it will only be told once you bring the next person, whether it's your son or your grandson, to become a man and receive their rite of passage. And
ooh, heavy.
So he leaves, and he finds this piece of glass, and he goes like, okay, so the secret of our tribe is that we were the first civilization on Earth, period. And that is the remnant of the once great city that we had. Sit, my grandson, and let me tell you a story. And that is our omnipotent narrator the rest of the time, where we get this crazy story about Dream and the Endless. That's what him and his immortal brethren are called. And how Dream fell in love with an African queen, you know, who's the queen of this village.
Okay.
Also note, this was borderline color time because, and this issue, we brown.
Nice. All right. Let's go.
And
moving up, yo. From gray to brown. Let's go.
So, back in these times, Dream was brown too. And so, he walks by the queen's tower one night. And the queen becomes instantly infatuated. And they take you through this tale of how the endless are forbidden from having relationships with humans, and great bad things happen. So it's like this reverse tale of lust, where first the queen goes and seeks out Dream for years. You know, she listens and talks to the animal spirits and leaves her land and wants to find this guy. Then she finds him and realizes that he's one of the endless. And then it's flipped, because she's like, even though I love you and I have this unbounding attraction to you, we can't be together because humans can't be with endless, and that's unfortunate. And so Dream chases her down, and it's like borderline date rape. The only thing that doesn't really make it date rape or puts us away from that, maybe, is that when the queen gives in, because of the lust they built up before it, seems like maybe she wanted it a little too, but really it's kind of date rape. But really, there's a little bit of credit to that, because if this is ancient mythos, I mean, you look at Greek gods and other pantheons, and they were pretty horrible with that, too.
They were pretty, I mean, Zeus basically, many of the women, many of his offsprings came from just rape, because he would disguise himself as somebody else and then sleep with somebody. That's really rape. You can't just trick a person sleeping with you and say, oh yeah, that's how it works. No, Zeus, you're a jerk. You raped her.
Yeah, so they wake up the next morning after the whole night of fun, and then, you know, she's thinking, oh, maybe being with the Endless is not so bad. Then the universe says, psych, giant comet comes down, blows up the city, and it's over. And then Dream is like, well, that kind of sucks, but I still love you. You can just come live with me in the realm of dreams and we'll be all right. And she begins to run. And she runs. And she runs. And Dream continues to persist because he's madly in love. And she eventually commits suicide. Mm. Then Dream goes to hell and is like, I'll give you one more chance to be with me before I banish you here forever. For an eternity. And she's like, no, y'all you saw what just happened. This can't happen again. Please don't ask me again, because if I actually say no, you're gonna have to banish me. And he's like, nah, I'm pretty sure I'm gonna ask again. And so that's how that one ends. And it was the story of the one time that Dream loved, and it sort of ties to the next arc, because his sister, who is Desire, may have had something to do with this. Mm. And so he was like, she's like, last time, that story, that was a mistake. This time, when I played a whole love game with Dream, it's going to be a little bit different. So we're sort of seeing how that plans out. But remember, this is the story from Dream's perspective of how it's about to play in a Sandman. You jump out, and there you got the boy and his grandfather telling the story, and he's like, so does she say yes? And he's like, of course she said no. And that's all there is to the story. So, this is his story. He has to go rehide his piece of glass and take it back to the tribe. The reason the tribe never tells the story is because if the world knew that this was the site of the first civilization and the first people, it might have a severe effect on their way of life. And then he says, maybe when the woman tells the story, there's a happier ending, but not the way the men have passed it down for years. The end. Mm-hmm. And that was like issue number 9, and I was like, that was just like a good comic all the way around.
Yeah.
Crazy levels of improvement. I'm excited to see where all of this goes.
So volume two is sort of when they started, Sandman started moving on its own merits, right? It's just on its own. All right. That's good. That's good.
So,
because I'm,
yeah,
I know that's kind of like a similar thing with New Mutants in the Marvel world. Like the first couple issues of New Mutants, like they had a lot of cameos from like just, you know, the regular X-Men, and then after a while they progressed out as their own title and their own team, and for a while they were selling more than the actual X-Men title. So that's always good.
Yeah, so that was, it looks like it's going in a very good direction. I'm enjoying Sandman. I think the original run was 75 issues, but then they've had like a couple of standalone graphic novels, as well as Sandman Overture, which I think is a prequel that's actually pretty recent. But Pilgrimage is very good, because, you know, I've been discovering over the past few years all the different corners outside the superhero realm of comics, and this was sort of the pioneer for that. So
Yeah, quite right. Yeah, Neil Gaiman. I've never read any of his pieces, but you know, just being within the comics world, you're gonna hear his name thrown around as just a force. And I was like, why is he so, you know? He's always spoken in the same sentence as the Frank Millers and the Alan Moores. And you're like, okay, well, these are heavy hitters. And so, yeah, don't forget Neil Gaiman. So I can totally see why. When I learned the whole Wonder Fantasy thing, why, like how we won it, and I was like, oh, that's hella impressive. Very impressive.
Yeah, so if you don't know where to start, or if you kind of wanted to read comics and superheroes weren't your thing, you can go pick up Sandman. Most bookstores have Sandman. They might not have the individual graphic novel volumes, which there were 12 of, but they have like these two Sandman omnibuses, and the Barnes and Nobles will have them, and it's like $50, but it collects the first six trades into one volume. If you get both of them, then you have the entire series. And I believe they were recolored for that also, because, you know, early 90s, in fact, before the mid 90s, you had your four color panel spread where you couldn't have more than four colors on a page. So
Right.
I believe that version is recolored. So Sandman be a good one to pick up.
Yeah, there's another one that I haven't gotten the privilege of reading a lot about. I think it's called Parker, actually, is actually another really good one to pick up if you don't want if you're trying to enter that area and it's like, not, you know, superheroes aren't really your thing, but you definitely want the visual, the visual, you know, storytelling. So yeah, it's Parker the Hunter. It's an IDW piece, and what's it called? Donald E. Westlake. He's the guy who wrote it. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, so since we're doing that whole little list, other things, Saga. I have not actually read Saga. Fiona Staples and Brian K. Vaughan are the series creators. It's an Image comic. It's really highly acclaimed. It's a full-on sci-fi space drama. They're like, if you love Star Wars and you love Star Trek, like, you will love Saga. I'm a Star Wars fan myself. I'm a comics fan myself.
Likewise.
And people are telling me I should read it. And honestly, there's no reason other than the fact that my pull list is pretty full that I haven't picked it up. But I've been saying that for years now, and it's kind of unfair. But there's other stuff that gets added when my pull list gets room and Saga gets pushed to the side again. But that's
Yeah.
a really good one. And if I had to do like one more genre, I don't read horror comics. Horror is not my genre. But I have drifted out of superheroes quite a bit a couple years. Oh, Wicked and Divine. Wicked.
Yeah.
That's like your modern. I don't even know what I'd call it other than modern. It's like a modern god story. And Wicked is actually fairly young. They're only just came out with volume 2. So they're, I think, 12 or 13 issues in. So the Wicked and the Divine, or Wicked for short, is a great one to pick up.
Oh yeah, I'd say another one that I have that's non-superhero related that I have heard great things about is it's a Valiant comic, Dr. Mirage. I've heard amazing things about it. Actually read like the like a quick I want to say the free it was like the first issue of it, and it was just super dope. And I was like, if you know, one it's one of those things where it's like, hey, If I had time on my, if I had pull list and all that, if I had space on my pull list, that's definitely the thing that I'd pick up. The death-defying Dr. Mirage. It's really dope. Deals with a woman who can see. She can. She's sort of, yeah, she's like a vessel. She's a medium for death, and she's a medium for vessels for people who have died, and they'll like talk to their, you know, their dead loved ones. So I guess she's sort of that. She's sort of that, like, that Ouija board, but she's the real deal. And she has, so she helps the dead and their spouses or those close to them, you know, come to a resolution and, you know, having that closure. But the one thing she can't do is her husband dies, and I guess for some reason, her powers limit her contacting him, or he doesn't want to be contacted by her. So while she's providing other people closure and resolution, she can't find her own. And what she's been, and that's kind of like the first arc is kind of about her trying to find him and get that re and gain that closure. So it's really dope. I've heard great things, and it's a Valiant comic, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, sounds pretty well. Random side note. As digital comics and trades gain more and more prominence, the term pull list will be interesting. Like, what if my kids are like, why is it called a pull list? And I have to explain. Well, back in the days of comic stores, they had comics every week, and they actually pulled the physical comics for you. So you could just walk in and pick up all your books. And, you know, when it's digital, you're not really pulling anything. You just got a monthly download list. And trades, you don't really buy by pull unless you're that tight with your comic book store owner, where he's like, I know you like trades. This one's coming out, so I ordered a copy of that for you.
Which is, so that term is definitely going to be very, very interesting in the future. Just like, what would they use to? Was you just gonna, you know, what is it? Just gonna be my download list, you know, just kind of.
I think they'll probably still say pull list and not, and just wonder why. I mean, if you think about it, the entire medium, comics, because they were the funny little news strips. That's not what we talk about anymore.
Exactly. They're way more serious, way more involved, way more substantial piece. Avenue, you know, it's just kind of, yeah, it's evolved into a far more respectable medium. It's not the funnies
it's removed from the word's
anymore.
origin.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting.
This is very cool. That's going to be a really cool thing right there.
But I think that was a very cool look at pilgrimages. You know, the early pilgrimage, the character study, and the event that will probably be a launching point for a lot of other things. Pretty good coverage.
Oh, absolutely. Awesome coverage right there.
So, anything you want to talk about before we call this one?
Let's see. I would say the very last thing that comes to mind for me would be within the pilgrimage realm that we just spoke about, and then going through the pilgrimage that kind of a, just given a, you know, a brief intro on the pilgrimage that we're each going on, is the value of good writing and just and how a tightly woven story makes for, you know, a great experience as a reader, you know. And as we said, comics have evolved into this respectable medium. And I think, and Lou, you actually made me think about this. The best was prior to us, you know, getting on here and getting on miking up, was with Injustice and how difficult it's been for me to stay with that after Tom King, right?
Tom
After,
Taylor.
yeah, Tom Taylor, after he kind of hopped off the book. And I actually really didn't realize it until you said that it's been difficult for you to stay current with it because of that. And I was like, yo, that's actually right, because, you know, I binged through year one of From Injustice, and, you know, and I guess, yeah, like, kind of in year two and all that stuff. But after he left, it was like, you know, when every, I guess, what, Wednesday or whatever, when they released the webcomics, I wasn't, you know, chomping at the bit to go read it. And now I kind of just don't remember what issue I left off at.
Yeah. The cool thing about Injustice for me wasn't all the crazy kills going on, which are part of the appeal, but it wasn't the real appeal. You know, Tom Taylor stayed sort of, you know, if you go back to the beginning, you talk about the equilibrium for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that tipped off the equilibrium seemed really logical. Like, my whole love through the first two-thirds of year two and all of year one was like, dang, that's exactly how that character would react. Mm-hmm. You know, the cool killings happened, but everything that led up to that cool death was a completely logical route for that character to take in a world where Superman's sort of spiraling into this dark place. And you sort of lose that. In fact, I said two-thirds year two. It was two-thirds in a year three, because years one and two are good.
Yeah.
And year three, there's a point where you're reading it, and there's a lot less character death. Which, year three was like the worst place for me personally for that to have happened, because just like I don't like horror, I don't dwell too far into the magic realm.
Right.
And year three is all about what's going on with these magic people. And so, you know, Taylor hops off the book, even though he's outlined what's supposed to happen through the end of year three. A lot of that stuff sort of just happens. And it's things like, wait, why the heck is Batman Etrigan now?
Yeah.
I still don't get it. I still don't get it. You know, I feel like that would have made more sense if Taylor was explaining me and walking me through that one. But it sort of just happened. And I don't know why, and now I don't know if that's exactly how it would have went down, and I sort of kind of needed more introspective, and I sort of just faded off the book after that.
Yeah. Likewise, Batman, because I was like, oh, snap, Batman's extra gun, and I'm like, why, though?
I don't get it.
I just can't completely understand. And then I was wondering, so why is the Spectre so OP now? I mean, I always thought I knew he was, like, strong, but it's like, didn't expect him to be able to kill the Phantom Stranger. I just thought that was a thing that you couldn't do. But clearly you just did. Huh? So, I'm confused, and I got lost, and I was like, alright. Let's just find something else to do, I guess. My brain just kind of subconsciously said, you know, this one doesn't really make a lot of sense to you anymore. Leave it alone.
Yeah, writing's important. Whoever tells you comics are more about the pictures, it's all very cohesive.
Yes.
It's not even just writing in pictures. There's a lot that goes into those pictures. So your penciler and your colorer and your letterer. And letters are crucial. I think they were underappreciated.
Absolutely. Through like
the 90s. But you have somebody who does the thought bubbles, right, bolds the right words, creates separate ones for different kinds of characters, which is also something Sandman was really pivotal on, because each of the Endless have their own distinct thought bubble or speech bubbles. And it's sort of a staple from the book, and people talk about it, and that's sort of when letterers started getting a little bit of shine. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, this can make a difference. I mean, not that it hasn't already been making a difference, but I never gave it enough credit.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, letterers are so very important. So I think one of my favorite letterers in the industry, his name is, and I'm going to definitely bastardize his last name, but it's Chris Eliopoulos. Like, he is awesome. He was a letterer for Ultimate Spider-Man. He was also the letterer for Hawkeye, the Hawkeye that was on with Pizza Dog and all that stuff. He also did the hand lettering for the first 100 issues of Savage Dragon, right? Dude is prolific. And it's like when you see his letters and you're like, wow, this is impressive. Very impressive. Like, it makes, yeah, visually, it just makes the book that much more amazing and memorable, you know? I feel like it's one of those things where, you know, when people order full prints of a page because it's just a great piece of art, yeah, that's another thing right there, where you're like, I'm going to order this page of this issue because the art is just spectacular.
Yeah. Especially letters add tone too, now that I think about it, because mm-hmm. it's just like if you're texting somebody or emailing somebody, you never know what mindset they're in when they're doing that. You know, a really stretched font will show that somebody's really stressed out at the moment. A really bolded font will say that somebody's really serious. Important aspect. So I guess that's your reading comics tip of the day. Pay attention to lettering.
Yep.
And it's a very cohesive process.
Yeah. It's very well, just very well put together piece of, you know, machinery, where it's like the sum of the parts creates a greater whole.
Yeah.
So, all right, sweet. So I think we've got everything that we wanted to tackle and more, actually. Maybe a giant-sized Comicidal Terror Hog podcast here. So, which, you know, which is not too bad. You can go through this piece by piece if you need to, everybody out there in the podcast world.
Yeah, so this was Lucius and As Wilson, and we'll be signing off. Till next time.
All right. Keep on reading, y'all.